Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy. Thank you for your company and welcome to the Book Show. This is the third Friday of the month. And on the third Friday of the month, we talk about books. And I am happy to welcome the panel today, Chris Hickey from the Whetstone branch of the Columbus Library. Chris Hickey comes to the program with the library's latest quick picks, which she will explain briefly. Mark Maxwell is back. That's good news. Mark Maxwell is here from Half Price Books. And there is no book show without Cassie Rose, who is WOSU's book critic. Her blog is thelongestchapter.com, which is important to anyone who loves to read. So, panel, welcome. Thank you for being here. As it approaches 90 degrees outside, we're in our air-conditioned studio in WOSU's new building. And Mark Maxwell, since you haven't seen you for a while, so I'd like to begin with you and ask you for a recommendation. What's a good read from Mark Maxwell?
Well, thanks for having me. Nice to see you all again. So the book that I'm really excited about right now is by a very hot new science fiction writer named Becky Chambers. So Becky Chambers has been around for a few years now. She's been racking up some awards. The book of hers that I want to recommend is called A Psalm for the Wild Belt. It's a novella, so it's a short novel. It came out over the summer. It's currently up for a Nebula Award in the novella category. So this is a book that's set on in a human society on a forested moon called Panga. And the main character is someone called Sibling Dex, who is a monk. Specifically, Dex is a tea monk. So their job is to take a wagon around to various villages, set up in the town square, and people come to them for tea and to unburden themselves of their problems.
You mean tea, like coffee and tea?
Tea. Okay. Dex is sort of a combination barista therapist, which may be true of all baristas. But Dex is having a bit of a vocational crisis, so they're not sure if they're really doing the right thing with their life. So they go on kind of a vision quest out into the wilderness where they meet a robot named Mosscap. Now, this is very significant because hundreds of years ago, robots were very common on Panga. But at some point, they all woke up and realized that they were robots and immediately headed out to the wilderness, never to be seen again. So this meeting between Dex and Mosscap is the first time a human has met a robot in generations. And it turns out that Mosscap is on a mission. So the other robots have been thinking about it, and they've decided that they feel a little bad about leaving humanity in the lurch. So they send Mosscap out to find some people and find out how they're doing and what they need. Most of this book is just a series of conversations between Dex and Mosscap. It doesn't have a lot of the things that we expect in science fiction. So there are no space battles. There are no laser gun fights. Some people would say that there's not much in this book by way of plot, which is a pretty common criticism of Becky Chambers. But people who like Becky Chambers, including me, note that she's giving us something that we don't often find in science fiction, which is a vision of humanity that is positive and optimistic. This is a planet where people live in well-designed, sustainable places, and they treat each other with compassion, and they use technology to make their lives better and not to make themselves miserable. If you combine that with some fairly complex characters and some pretty charming dialogue, it makes a compelling package.
When you say novella, a short book, a very long short story, or a very short novel, is it just enough? Did you want to know more?
Well, I did want to know more, but this, like many science fiction books, like almost all science fiction books now, this is intended to be part of a series. So there is a second book that's just coming out that I'm very excited to get into.
And Becky Chambers, I believe you mentioned, is an author you know, or you know about.
She's well known. I don't know her personally. She's very popular in the science fiction world.
Okay. Mark Maxwell is from Half Price Books and has led off with a discussion of science fiction. I know that and graphic novels are another interest of yours, and right. We'll talk more about your choices later in the broadcast. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is Half Price Books with Mark Maxwell. This is All Sides Weekend Books. I've been up since 4 a.m., and don't start with me, okay?
We'll take it.
I'm delighted to have you all here. This is the monthly book show where we're going to talk about with Chris Hickey right now. What is a quick pick from the the Columbus Library. You're at the Whetstone Branch, which is very well traveled, very busy,
yes,
very popular
busy.
Destination. What's a quick pick, and then recommend one for us?
All right, so quick picks are a special collection. These are the hottest books. These are the books with very long holds. And the idea is that you could come into one of our buildings, and they're in all of the buildings. And that book that you have on hold is sitting there waiting for you. So you could be number 567, but it happens to be on the shelf when you walk in. You check it out and you get to jump the line. So I will share a thriller. So this is the new Adrian McKinty, and it's called The Island. And this is about a family that takes a trip to Australia. They're a newly blended family, so they want to have this bonding trip. You know, the new stepmother doesn't really get along with the children, but, you know, is hoping to change that. So while they're in Australia, they discover this island that is closed to visitors. And so they talk their way onto the ferry and get on this island and figure out that things are horribly, this was a mistake. So they go on the island. It's run by a tight-knit group of locals. And something happens. And now they're running for their lives. So the husband and wife become separated, and the woman is now trying to protect her children from these people who are hunting them through this very harsh island. And what's interesting about this book is it's based on a real experience that the author went through. So his family went on a trip to Australia. They went to a small island that was not open to visitors, but were able to talk their way onto the ferry. They went there. And the vibe was off. So it's run by one family. So this is an island inhabited by one family. You know, people were carrying shotguns because they were hunting rabbits for their food, and it was just a very odd experience. And as
so
they
not
were
touristy.
Racing, no, but somehow they went there.
A little Lord of the Flies-ish.
Okay. So as they are racing to get back to the ferry, it's the last ferry off the island for the night, they almost hit a woman on a bicycle. And they make it to the ferry, get off safely. And his wife said to him, if we had hit that woman, I don't think we would have gotten off this island alive. And so he tells the story to his book agent, and the book agent says, you did hit her, and that is your next book. So I won't say anything more about that, but
because
that's
The
Island
the
by Aaron McKinty. You have to read the book to find out what happens, but it's very intriguing since he kind of lived this odd experience.
But it's a novel.
Island. It's a novel.
It's a novel. Okay.
It's not, he didn't actually hit her. This is what would have happened had he hit her.
And I suspect it doesn't go well for quite a while. We'll say no more.
We'll
I
don't say no more. It's a thriller.
Give it
lots
away
of twists and turns and excitement.
That is a quick pick from the Columbus Library called The Island by
Adrian McKinty.
From Chris Hickey, who is with she is the Youth Services Manager at the Whetstone Branch of the Columbus Library System, and she is a regular contributor to All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy, and it's time to talk with Cassie Rose, who is WOSU's book critic. You hear her on this station regularly, and you also go to her blog, thelongestchapter.com. What are you reading, Cassie Rose?
I think I'm going to start with the book that won the Best Novel of the Year award with the Edgars. And the Edgars, I would say, are to the mystery and the crime genre. They are the National Book Award. They are the Pulitzers. So to say that this is the best novel of the year says a lot that this book won it. And I will say they nailed it this time. It's called Five Decembers by James Kestrel. And we're on radio, so you can't see the book cover, but it is a pulp type cover, the kind that you would see on the pulp paperbacks that were published between World War II and the 1960s.
Those dirty books.
They were the Mickey Spillane right. books and all that. So, and it's published by a publisher called Hard Crime. Hard Case Crime, that's what it's called. And they are bringing that kind of feel back with new authors, but also publishing classics. Like they have Joyce Carol Oates has published a book in their series, and also Stephen King. This one, though, James Kestrel, it's the atmosphere and also the detective, Joe McGrady. He's drinking a whiskey, sitting at the bar at the opening page. He's done with the day. It's 8 o'clock at night, phone call happens at the bar. The bartender comes up to him, says, it's your captain. So he goes upstairs to a room, makes the call to his captain, finds out there's a murder, and it's on a plantation in Honolulu, and he has to get in the car and go way out to this plantation. Now, the thing is that it is November, Thanksgiving, and it is 1941. So we know what's coming. So the murder is of a young man who is the nephew of a Navy admiral. And there also turns out to be a girl that has been murdered too. So Joe gets this case, and a lot of people are involved with it. And there is another murder that happens on Wake Island, and that murder connects them to this murder and puts Joe McGrady on airplanes flying to Wake Island and also to Hong Kong. And before he leaves, he makes a reservation for his girlfriend and himself for Christmas. And he says, I should be back in 15 days, which, of course, we know he won't be, because we know what's going to happen on December 7th at Pearl Harbor. So he's in Hong Kong when it all happens. And at that point, I'm going to stop because I don't want to have any spoilers. But I will say this takes place in Hawaii, in Hong Kong, in Tokyo. And it's not a page turner, but it's one of those books where it's immersive. So you sit down and say, I've got about half an hour to read, so I'm just going to read for half an hour. And you look up and it's been 2 hours later and you've missed your appointment. So I'm giving you fair warning here that if you start this book, you're going to miss some of your appointments.
So you have an American in Tokyo or the Far East on like December 10th, 1941, or just after Pearl Harbor?
Yes. I mean, he's chasing the person that he knows has committed the crime, and who's a very mysterious person who has the name of John Smith on his passport. And yes, Joe McGrady is in Hong Kong, and he finds himself also in jail by the time that the bombing hits on December 7th. And so trying to get help is not very easy, but the kind of help that does come is extraordinary. And that's what happens here. It's maybe extraordinary, but it's all believable. And it's all the twists and the turns and the complexity that take him through five Decembers, so from 1941 to 1945. It's phenomenally good, and all of the characters are well developed. And there's a little bit of romance in there, too, the kind that you believe and that creates some tension and some heartache.
Give us the title and the author again.
The author is James Kestrel, and the book is Five Decembers.
Five Decembers, and it just won the Edgar Award for Best Crime Fiction,
Best Novel of the Year.
So it's an award winner, and if you have 30 minutes to kill, it'll cost you 2 hours, and that's a great recommendation for a book, I must say. Mm. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books. We're going to take a quick break and come right back. Don't go away. We are back. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books. My guests are Mark Maxwell from Half Price Books, Chris Hickey from the Whetstone Branch at the Columbus Library. Chris Hickey brings us the library's latest quick picks, which come out on Tuesdays, right?
They come out on Tuesdays.
Review how that works so people know.
That's a release date, and so a lot of the new items will come out on that date, and so we put the new quick picks out on Tuesday mornings.
And they're the same in every branch, right?
They are the same in every branch.
Okay, so Tuesday morning is where you want to be if you want to be first in line at the
Absolutely.
Library. Absolutely. Okay. And Cassie Rose, who is WOH's book critic, and her blog is thelongestchapter.com. I want to ask you for another quick pick, Chris Hickey, since we've been talking about quick picks.
Okay. Jennifer Grey from Dirty Dancing has a memoir. So, and I love a good memoir with 80s nostalgia. So I'm listening to this on audio. So it's Out of the Corner by Jennifer Grey. And famously, after that film, she had several nose jobs and became unrecognizable. and her career was over. So if you're interested in the story behind that, it is in this book. It is in the prologue. So she gets to it right away because she knows that's what people want to know.
How
about.
Do you have several nose jobs? I don't.
Well, one there was a
work?
Problem. Oh. One, there was an issue that needed to be corrected, and he corrected it so much that the composition of her face changed. I mean, she looked like a different person. She would say she was Jennifer Grey, and people didn't believe her. So that was, and then she just didn't get work after that. But it's a really interesting story, and she's the daughter of Joel Grey, who famously, you know, originated the role of the master of ceremonies in Cabaret. And she lovingly talks about her time with him when he was on Broadway. He would take her to the theater with him on Saturdays, and she would sit in his dressing room and watch him transform into that character with the makeup and the costumes. And then he would take her by the hand, and they would walk through the backstage together. And she would watch him from the wings. And, you know, the Kit Kat girls would make a fuss over her. And it was just a really cool thing that she explained. And her mother is Jo Wilder, the actress. And so she talks about that. She talks about the men in her life. And she dated a number of people right before they were big. So Johnny Depp. She dated Johnny Depp in the 21 Jump Street days. And as we know, he's all over. His personal life is fully on display right now, but she only has nice things to say.
Cassie Rose and I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, but she dated Matthew Broderick from Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Billy Baldwin, and she tells this amazing story about how she met Billy Baldwin. So Madonna threw her a party.
Oh,
yeah. Madonna threw her a party. She was very big at the time. And Madonna said, all right, who do you have a crush on? Who do you like? And she said, well, I don't know. And well, I did see this play and there was this man and I think his name is Alex Baldwin. I don't know. And she's like, OK, he's coming to the party. So calls him up. Of course, he doesn't believe her. And this is before Alec Baldwin was Alec Baldwin. Mm-hmm. And he didn't believe her. He thought he was being pranked. And so he brought his brother Billy with him to the party because he wasn't going to go by himself. And then sparks flew between Jennifer Grey and Billy Baldwin. So there's lots of juicy details about the men in her life. So it's just it's fun. She reads it in the audiobook, so I'm enjoying just listening to her stories. And of course, I had to stay up and watch Dirty Dancing last night.
But she doesn't look like... I mean, the way she's portrayed on the cover, that's the way she looked in Dirty Dancing, right?
She doesn't look like that now. It does. That is what she looks like now. And it does look like
her. Of course she doesn't. She's 52 years old now.
She looks great.
Yeah. She did have a pretty prominent nose in the early days.
If you do look at the comparison photos, there is a difference. But, I mean, she looks great either way.
For those of you listening on the radio, take my...
Yes. Google pictures of Jennifer Grey before and
woman.
After, and you'll
she's
know
nice,
what we're
She's a
about.
Nice-looking woman. But, no, that sounds like a lot of fun. That sounds like
it's a fun read,
and hopefully it ends well. I mean, let's decide.
She seems fine.
She's having a good.
I think she's all right.
Having
did,
a good time,
okay.
And she's written a very successful book. And we're going to go from that to one of Mark Maxwell's science fiction crazies or something wonderful like that. What do you have for us?
I have a book by George Saunders, who's one of my favorite writers. George Saunders is probably best known for his novel Lincoln and Nabardo, which won awards a few years ago. But this is a book of nonfiction. So it's called A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, in which four Russians give a masterclass on writing, reading, and life. So this is a class that he's been teaching for a couple of decades, is my understanding. And what he does is he takes several well-known short stories by Russian writers, Chekhov, Tolstoy, and he prints them. They're in the book, and then he kind of breaks them apart afterwards. What makes them tick? You know, what do we see about these characters? What do we know about them? How do we find these things out? And it's interesting because George Saunders, for a couple of reasons. One, because George Saunders has a previous book of nonfiction, but this is his first book that's just about literature and just about writing. So it's really fascinating to kind of see into his head and what he's looking at when he's reading fiction. It's also interesting to me because I would not have imagined that George Saunders would go for classic Russian short stories. If you're familiar with George Saunders, and he does primarily work in the medium of short stories, you know, his stories are very strange and frenetic, and they're very novel. And so it's interesting to me that he goes back for sort of the classic Russian short stories to illustrate how the form works and how the structure works. You know, I have always had kind of a blind spot for the Russian writers. And he confesses in this book that he did too for the longest time. And there's a kind of a moving passage in this book where he describes a moment where he is in school and his professor, who is Tobias Wolff, the author, is reading a Chekhov short story out loud. And that's how he falls in love with the Russians. So if you're interested in what writers are looking for when they look at short stories, this is a really great place to start. It came out last year, but it was just released in paperback. So now is a really great time to pick it up.
I've actually seen that on a display at the Whetstone Branch at the Columbus Library. And I've been meaning to pick it up, and I will know, because Lincoln and the Bardo, which is a novel, was one of the most moving and sad but wonderful books at the same time.
Yeah.
About how Abraham Lincoln just went into his son's grave because he was so devastated. He couldn't leave the boy there. You know what I mean? It was just heartrending. And
it's moving. Yeah.
Yeah, the way that he painted that. But this is a nonfiction book. It's like a class, is what you're saying.
It's like a class, yeah.
But it doesn't read like it's not dull, in other words.
No, I mean, George Saunders consistently is a very engaging,
yes,
very readable writer. So it's a little different from his fiction, obviously, but there are some great notes in here. And there are, though it's not primarily about how he approaches his craft, there are some interesting anecdotes about how he kind of finds his voice. There's an interesting passage about how a particularly bad sentence in one of his students' essays prompted him to find the voice for one of his more famous short stories.
What's the title of it again?
It's called A Swim in a Pond in the Rain.
By George Saunders.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for that. Cassie Rose, what do you have for us now?
I have a nonfiction recommendation. It's a book called Uncommon Measure, and it's by Natalie Hodges. And the subtitle on it is A Journey Through Music, Performance, and the Science of Time. And Natalie Hodges is a violinist, and she studied to be a solo violinist. And so you know that that means from the age of like 4 or 5, and she started practicing 6 hours a day of the violin. And she did this because she wanted to. She loved the violin. It wasn't under duress from a tiger mom or anything. But as she grew older, she developed performance anxiety. And that's what this book is about, because when she was a senior, I think in high school, she was performing and got to a certain passage, and she dropped the bow, and she got herself through it because she was close to the end, and she finished by doing a pizzicato with the strings. And it didn't, at that point, she didn't stop, but that is the grounding moment in the book where she begins and says, I wanted to figure out what was going on. And that is where the science and the time come into this. Now, when you start the book with the prelude, she talks about atoms in a science way that I thought, I'm not going to be able to get through this book. I don't want a science book. But after that, when she starts, she talks about herself. So it becomes memoir, and then she goes into science to figure out that science of time, of when you're performing and you're within the time of the music, not the rhythm and the beat, but it is that zone that you are in and that you are captured in, and what happens when you become self-conscious and you go out of it. And she uses science, which actually perfectly balances this memoir, to understand what can happen and does happen with time. She talks about her studies with professors. She talks about her relationship with her mother, which was wonderful. She talks about her love of performing, but not being able to do it. And I found it captivating, and also the science captivating. And I probably should also reveal why I was drawn to the book, because the same thing happened to me, not with the violin, but with the piano on stage. I got within 5 or 7 measures of performing a Brahms intermezzo in front of an auditorium, and I left that time of the music and became self-conscious. And within a split second, a voice inside my head said, "Cut off your thoughts from your hands," which I did. And my fingers then finished the piece. And
I have never
chills just hearing you talk about that.
So nobody knows that that happened, and I believed it was just anxiety I could overcome. And now that was many years ago, and I continued. I was studying at a conservatory, not on the level of Natalie Hodges, but I loved studying the piano, and I'd become pretty advanced, and I wanted to continue, and I thought I could come through this anxiety, but I couldn't, and a year later had to quit. And I thought it was me. And I bring that up to say, this is another reason we read books. We read like the pulp fiction I just talked about that I absolutely loved. And then we read because of this book, which helps us to understand our own lives while we enjoy reading about someone else. And that's what she brought to me. And maybe could also do so for many people that have some sort of a performance anxiety. But it's beautifully written. It feels very personal, too. And I highly recommend it.
I'm going to have to buy it because one doesn't ask to borrow books from Cassie Rose. She doesn't do that. So, but I definitely want to read that book. And I thank you very much for the recommendation there. It reminds me of a book that I read recently. And I got to interview the author, which was wonderful. Every Good Boy Does Fine by the pianist Jeremy Dank, who's a professional. He has a career as a concert pianist and also as a blogger. And It's about becoming what it takes to become a concert pianist, but there's a lot more to it. There's a lot of self-discovery, and it sounds, the way I'm describing it is very cliched, and the book is not. But if you want a book about how to become a musician, how to live, you know, just how to live, Every Good Boy Does Fine, and it's also a lot of fun. By Jeremy Dank, I recommend that very much.
I just read about that book in the Times Literary Supplement. You got a very good review and made me want to read it.
He's a very engaging. We did a Zoom interview that's on the Classical 101 WOSU Facebook page. And there he was in his ball cap. And he was in the midst of a rehearsal. Said, yeah, they'll wait for me. Come on, let's hang out. Let's talk. Mm-hmm. I have to have a beer. Let's come on. So we had a nice time. He was he was very, very engaging. And it's a marvelous book. And he's a marvelous pianist anyway. But I digress. I read something, too, that I just wanted to throw out there because you were talking about Jennifer Grey. I just read the memoir by Viola Davis called Finding Me, which is, I think it's the number one bestseller right now on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list.
It is a quick pick.
It's a quick pick, too. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, it is, because I've got it. And it's overdue, and I don't care. Because you'll put a good word in for me. But her whole upbringing, she grew up in Rhode Island, is harrowing. I mean, it's like it's Dickens, but not charming. You know, it's rats, it's starvation, it's bedwetting, it's no heat. I mean, how anybody survived that, and most of her family did not, because she had a lot of siblings, and she was the only one who really was able to bring herself to the surface, and get out there. Is an incredible story. It's not a Hollywood book. I mean, the last 20 pages, she's making a movie with Meryl Streep, but the first 200 pages have nothing to do with that, and it's well worth the read. I'm not surprised it's so popular, Finding Me by Viola Davis. And this is The Book Show, and I'm Christopher Purdy with Cassie Rose, Chris Hickey, and Mark Maxwell. How about, Chris Hickey, another quick pick for us?
Okay, let's talk about the new E. Lockhart. This is Family of Liars. So this is the prequel to her runaway hit, We Were Liars. So We Were Liars came out in 2015, and it was very popular then. But a resurgence on TikTok has made it wildly popular now. So that book is hard to get a hold of. So E. Lockhart wrote a prequel about the mothers in this book, Family of Liars. So We Were Liars.
Give us a little precise about family.
Because it won't make sense otherwise.
Little context.
So We Were Liars is about a wealthy family called the Sinclairs, and they summer on their own private island off of Martha's Vineyard. And a group of cousins and friends that particular summer, they refer to themselves as the Liars because this tragic, awful thing has happened. And they're all unreliable. They're unreliable narrators. And so in Family of Liars, we learn they get it from their mothers. Their mothers are also liars, and their grandparents. So this is the story of the mothers. So the three women, the Sinclair sisters, in 1987. And we get a glimpse of the grandmother. So the grandmother is deceased in We Were Liars. But now we've met Tipper Sinclair. And she's very interesting. So this particular summer, there was a fourth sister, and the summer before, she drowns. So this is the youngest sister. So this is their first family summer on the island after losing that child. And the mother Tipper is very involved with planning these elaborate parties as a distraction for herself. And like one has to do with finding lemons. They go on this lemon scavenger hunt and everything is yellow and there's just a whole theme. It's interesting, the author E. Lockhart has these parties because she says when you see your characters having fun, you start to care about them more, which I thought was an interesting observation. So one of the cousins of the Sinclair sisters brings her boyfriend and this group of boys. They come to the island for the summer, and a lot of drama ensues around one particular boy. And she writes it in a way where you don't know what happened until the end. It's going to keep you guessing. And the main character, the narrator, is one of the women named Carrie. And she had just had jaw surgery, so she's now addicted to painkillers. And so she's also unreliable, and she's seeing the ghost of her sister repeatedly. So it is very much like the first book. If you enjoyed We Were Liars, you will enjoy Family of Liars. It's a deeper dive into this family dynamic. And also like how extremely rich people live when you have your own private island. And you can do such things.
As one does. but it's a quick pick.
It is a quick pick. It is called Family of Liars by E. Lockhart.
That's a quick pick from the Columbus Library, recommended to us by Chris Hickey. We are going to take one more break and come back, and Mark Maxwell is going to give us some more recommendations. Don't go away. This is All Sides Weekend Books. We are back, All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy with Cassie Rose, WOH's book critic. Chris Hickey from the Columbus Library. Chris Hickey brings us the library's latest quick picks, and Mark Maxwell is here from Half Price Books. Your turn, Mark Maxwell. What do you have for us to read?
I brought the new book from Chuck Klosterman. So Chuck Klosterman is a writer and cultural critic who's been coming out with books for about 20 years now. And his new book is called The 90s, a book. So this is not a history of the 90s. It's more of a kind of cultural and social appreciation. So Klosterman is kind of a culture vulture. He is stuffed full of arcane details about all kinds of culture. And this is kind of a guided tour of the 90s. So he writes about music. He writes about film. He writes about television. He writes about culture. One of his major ideas is that the 90s is the last decade. And what he means by that is that the 90s was the last decade before the internet. Now, with the internet now, we have access instantly to every piece of information, every piece of culture in history. And Klosterman's argument is that that is kind of flattened out culture. Instead of a regular progression of culture, now we have sort of the eternal now. So there's less difference between, 2010 and 2020 culture than there was between 1980 and 1990. So this is, I'm not sure if I agree with Klosterman about necessarily everything that he's saying. He's got some opinions. He, relevant to this show, he picks the two sort of most iconic writers of the 90s. And his choices are Elizabeth Wurtzel, who wrote the book Prozac Nation, and Mark Lehner, who wrote a number of comic novels in the 90s. And that's sort of gratifying to me because I think Klosterman and I are the only two people that remember Mark Lehner from the 90s. But I definitely would have gone with David Foster Wallace. So there you go.
Oh, there you are. Is he in there?
He is mentioned.
He's more 80s, isn't he?
Well, his Infinite Jest came out in the 90s.
Okay, that's right,
so
yeah.
So I would put him in the 90s. And he's mentioned a couple of times briefly. He's actually mentioned once in the bit about Mark Lehner, because David Foster Wallace has some pretty good quotes about Mark Lehner, including the idea that Mark Lehner may be the Antichrist. Which I don't think is true. But I would have gone with David Foster Wallace. He's mentioned a couple of other times in terms of like philosophy. But it's a pretty fun romp through the 90s. And if you have fond memories of the 90s, as I do, it's a very enjoyable read.
I should read that, because when you began to speak about the 90s, I went, the 90s, eh. You know, the 90s were not, you know, the 80s, some of us were, you know, that we're still alive, having lived the 80s the way we did is a testament to something. But I should check that out, because there are things that will be certainly in living memory for me about that. What is it about his writing that brings you back there?
So Chuck Klosterman is, well, he's always excessively readable. I mean, he's a very good line writer. He kind of pulls you along. But what strikes me and what makes it entertaining, and I think what kind of takes you back to the era, is his attention to detail. So you will find out things about the band Nirvana that you didn't know, even if you know a lot about Nirvana, as many people do.
Two of them have grandchildren now. Did you know that?
It's depressing. It's
yes,
a little,
yes,
it's a little depressing.
Very, very sad. Yes. Chuck Klosterman's the 90s.
The 90s, a book.
Has he done other decades?
No, he hasn't. So okay. I think that he feels that it's, you know, he's uniquely qualified to write about the 90s because that was sort of the beginning of
his career. But I do love your point about how it's just, it was the last call before the internet changed everything.
Right.
Yeah, I'd love that. I hadn't thought about it that way. But
there's
yes,
some truth
course.
To that for
yes.
sure.
Yeah. Cassie Rose, what do you have for us as well? Top that for the 90s.
Right. Well, there's a book I really want to talk about. I just wrote about it on The Longest Chapter, but I can't not mention it here. It's called Gentlemen Overboard, and it's by Herbert Clyde Lewis. And I will also, I think this might give us an opportunity, Chris, to talk about OhioLINK and people being able to access books there, because that is how you can get this book on the library. It was originally published in 1937. It has been brought back into print by a series called Recovered Books by Boiler House Press. And it is a novella, and it is what you would call a tragic comedy. So the tragic part of it is a man falls off the deck of a ship on his way from Hawaii to Panama. And that's the tragic part of it. The comic part of it is, first of all, he slips on a grease spot and he goes overboard at 5 a.m. in the morning, and he's a gentleman. And being a gentleman, he's been trained not to scream and shout and rave for help.
At 5 o'clock in the morning.
So there he is in the water. And he is a respectable New York businessman. He has been traveling by himself, and he's in this calm seas of the Pacific Ocean. He has a wife and two children, and he's sure that the SS Arabella is going to turn around and come back and get him. And so he never goes into despair. More so, he feels more ashamed that this has happened to him, and because this is, and he wants to beg everybody's pardon for it. And then he begins to think about things like, well, he has to take all his clothes off so he can float better. And then he becomes embarrassed because he's in blue and yellow striped boxer shorts. And what's going to happen when the people rescue him and he's going to be seen like that? And then he thinks, oh, but when I am rescued, I'll be not a hero for having survived the elements. And back at the brokerage firm, I will be set apart. So that is his mindset. And yet at the same time, we're watching the SS Arabella sail away. But the author keeps that levity, but also that seriousness going on. And he's really working with an experiment, and that is what happens between that time of when you, say, are standing on a rooftop, perfectly secure, and you fall off. That gap, that mental gap of time before you hit the street. And the author had that moment, which is written about in the acknowledgments, by a gentleman named, I think it's Brad Bigelow. He is the founder of Neglected Books, which is a website I highly recommend. Anyway, he shares that story about when the idea came to him, to this Herbert Clyde Lewis. And he wanted to explore that. What is that mental gap? Where do you go? And so that's what he does with this Henry Preston Standish, who is in the water. Now, it's a little bit unbelievable that he treads water and for a good 24 hours, I would say, doesn't have any of the sufferings that one would expect. And he observes the porpoises.
How does he get his clothes off if he's underwater? I mean, that's what...
Oh, he does that and he secures the wallet.
I'm going to have to read the book.
He secures the wallet.
Nice job.
He's very sensible.
He's very sensible, yes.
In a way, he's very ingenious. I mean, so clearly he's meant to survive. I don't know what happens, and I'm not asking you to tell us, but I'm just, yeah.
No, but he goes to places. It is not depressing at all. You come away from it thoughtful and also just going, Mark, you are just looking at me with a way that is just this, you want to just burst out laughing. But it is that seriousness of, he does have a moment where he thinks of the empty spaces. He thinks, well, at Christmas, the elevator boy isn't going to have money in his pocket. And what about my empty easy chair?
But he's a broker on Wall Street and he's self-effacing. What's going on?
I know, but he thinks of it,
it's
fiction. It's fiction. Well, the empty spaces that are going to... So it's unusual that the author didn't take him down the path of, I'm going to relive my life every moment of it. He doesn't do that. But he also goes to the passengers on board. It's that, you know, why are they not noticing that he's missing?
Not there.
That he isn't. And especially, you know, in the cook. And the thing is that he had this secret place in the hull of the ship that he went to at 5 a.m. That is, Henry Preston Standish did. But that was the place where the cook would go and throw the leftover food out into the water. And so that's why there was a grease spot there. Anyway, it's really a wonderful book to read in the fact that, yes, you do go into that profound space of thinking about that mental gap, and not in a despairing way. He just explores it. And then you will never forget Henry Preston Standish.
What intrigues me is that my assumption is that this book was out of print for 60 years from then, and how a present-day entity would find a book like this that no one's ever heard of for 60 years and bring it back and have it be so compelling. I mean, that's it. Very interesting to me.
Yes, and actually it went bonkers for sales in Argentina and Israel and I think the Netherlands, and then we've just recently picked it up in England and the United States. And so, yes, for so long it just sat out of print, and now it has been rediscovered, which is what I think the neglectedbooks.com, that website, is about, and Brad Bigelow, who follows that, or who creates it. And I think he might have had a hand also in the resurgence of this. Yes, it is. Brad Bigelow is. And he writes the epilogue, Herbert Clyde Lewis and the Rescue of Gentlemen Overboard, in the back of the book, which, by the way, if you get onto the library, search for it, and it comes up empty, go to OhioLINK, and you will find the book there. And if I recommend it on my blog, if you can't find it, to ask for help from your reference librarian.
Yes, we can help you with that. So there's several options, and when that search comes up and it says zero, in the top right corner, there is an additional search, and that will take you to OhioLINK. And then if it's not an OhioLINK, it'll go on further. There are several different layers, and each one casts a wider net, and we can usually find just about anything. So if you struggle, call us, come and see us.
Right, and if you can, if you have access, the OSU library system is also very, very good at finding books. They may very well have it in the... but, you know, $5, Johnny Depp will do the movie. See? A year from now, we're going to come back and do the show and that movie, and we'll go see it together, okay?
He doesn't seem sensible, though.
Well,
this
I mean, he's
a sensible character.
That's fiction, and he's an actor.
That's true.
There you go.
All right.
This is All Sides Weekend Book. I'm Christopher Purdy. We have a few minutes left. Let's try to survive. Chris Hickey, give us another quick pick from the library.
All right, let's talk about a ghost story.
Let's.
So this is called The Hacienda by Isabella Cañas. This is a debut novel. And as she was writing this book at the beginning of the pandemic, she became very aware of being in her own house. So she was inspired to write a haunted house book. So it takes place at the end of the Mexican War for Independence. And it's about a woman named, is it Isabel? It's Beatrice. Beatrice. And her father is killed during the war. She's lost her home. And so when this man, Don Rodolfo, proposes, she thinks this is a good prospect, even though there are rumors about the demise of his first wife. So she sees his country estate as, you know, security. But after she marries him, she realizes that it's anything but that. So it's being compared to that Mexican Gothic, which was such a big hit, and Rebecca. So, yes, so this is getting a lot of good press. So when her husband goes back to the city to work, she's now in this estate and she feels watched by some presence in this house. And her sister-in-law says, oh, you know, it's nothing. You don't know what you're talking about. But the same sister-in-law will not enter the house after dark. And so Beatrice gets to know this priest who is also a brujo, which is a male witch, and they try to solve what is happening in this house. So it is very, very creepy. And Isabel Cañas says that when she was a child, her parents would put her in the creepy basement as a punishment when she was naughty, which is it's terrible. That's but she's horrible. Had lots of time to think about what makes a space scary and creepy, and she brings all of that into this book.
Well, she put it to good use then.
She put her childhood trauma to good use.
An inspiration to parents everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah, and she may burn her parents' house down too if she's not. They're like, wow, that's okay.
Yeah.
Just remind us of the title and the
The Hacienda by Isabel Cañas.
That's a quick pick from the Columbus Library. Chris Hickey, we have time for Mark Maxwell to give us another recommendation.
On the way in, Chris mentioned seeing Neil Gaiman he was in town recently. So Netflix is about to come out with a TV adaptation of his comic series The Sandman. I have no idea what the TV adaptation is going to be like, but I'll just remind everyone that cool kids read the book first. So if you haven't had the opportunity to check out The Sandman, it's collected now in several volumes, and now would be a great time to check it out.
I bet you could find it at Half Price Books.
You could definitely find it at Half Price Books.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me ask you again, just so let me know, the one I go to now is Bethel Road. I go there a lot, and I love it. It's great. I love Half Price Books, but where else are you now? Because it's changing.
So we've got four stores in town. There's okay. Bethel Road. There's East Broad Street. There's Lewis Center.
Oh.
And then there's our store in Westerville. All wonderful stores.
Where on East Broad Street?
It is at, it's on East, it's in Reynoldsburg.
Reynoldsburg, okay.
So it's in the Shops at East Broad, okay. Which is kind of there there as you're going up towards Delaware.
And catch us up. What do you do with them now? What do you do with
I'm the assistant district manager in Columbus. So along with my boss, the district manager, Chris Hewing, we oversee the four stores. And it's about to be five again. So our Lane Avenue store, which went away a couple of years ago, we will be coming back probably next year in 2023.
Oh, that's terrific. That's good to know. Thank you. That's a destination for a lot of people who love to read and still buy CDs. I know a lot of you out there don't know what a CD is, but some of us, you know, go buy CDs and DVD. We still want them, and they're there. So
indeed,
That's wonderful to have that at Half Price Books. We have 3 minutes left. Any burning desires to share a book in our last few minutes?
I have a beach reedy type
please.
Of book.
Oh, please, yes, wonderful.
Book Lovers by Emily Henry. She wrote The People We Meet on Vacation and Beach Read. But this one, it's light, it's fun. Steamy romance. So
you should have a beach read display at Whetstone. Yep,
do. I'll get right on that.
I'll be heading
back to the branch. I'll work on that today.
And Cassie Rose's blog is thelongestchapter.com, which is important for anyone who loves to read. It's very, very informative, and it's a lot of fun. I thank you all for coming in today for today's Half Price. I did it again, didn't I?
Because it's
I
keep fine.
Looking,
it's
I
fine.
Know it
you
is.
Can
yes.
say Half Price Books as many times as you
All
like.
Sides Weekend Books. The next time you come, I'll try to have sleep the night before, but who knows? Thank you, Cassie Rose, WOSU's book
critic.
It's
always a pleasure.
Thank you, Chris Hickey from the Whetstone branch. Say hi to everybody at Whetstone. You work with some very good people
thank
over
you.
There.
They love it when you say that.
Well,
it makes
there
the,
you
it
are.
Means a great deal.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mark Maxwell, for coming back. We'll have you again at Half Price Books, four, soon to be five stores.
You heard it here, ladies and gentlemen.
In Central Ohio. Thank you, Bobby Gerbig, for keeping us on the QT and keeping us on the radio. Thank you, Marcus Charleston, the producer of All Sides. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books on 89.7 NPR News. Keep reading.